From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The vetting and the speculation are over. Now the politicking and predictions kick in. With Brett Kavanaugh's nomination, Americans get a real-time refresher course on how a judge gets to the Supreme Court. But do you know how cases get there? Fred Smith is here to talk us through that process in English. Right, Fred?
Absolutely. I'll do my best.
He's associate professor of law at Emory. So, Fred, first, a little reminder here. How the Supreme Court fits into the three branches of government.
Sure. Right. So the Supreme Court is, of course, the head of the judicial branch. Right. So the president's the head of the executive, Congress. And that is, so that would be the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader would be the head of the legislative branch. And the Supreme Court is the head of the judiciary. And beneath them is another level of Court of Appeals. That's where Judge Kavanaugh, for example, is at this moment. And just below that is the trial court level, which are called federal district courts.
All right. So let's actually follow a case through that, like
sure.
a trial court. I wanted to pick a case that was from Georgia, Foster versus Chatman.
Sure.
All right. So first, a little bit on this case.
Yeah. So absolutely. So some cases get to the Supreme Court through the state system, right? That is, someone goes to a state trial court, and then they go to a state court of appeals or the state Supreme Court, and then they go to the United States Supreme Court. The case of Foster versus Chatman got to the Supreme Court that way.
Okay. So somebody went through a state court system, did not like the verdict, so appealed it.
That's exactly right. So in his particular circumstances, he was convicted, he was sentenced to death, and later there was evidence that his jury was selected with racial bias. That is, that the prosecutor had intentionally gotten rid of every black potential juror, wrote the word B by all of the jurors, black jurors, circled them, highlighted them, wrote words like no black and no black church. And so that evidence later came to light. The Georgia Supreme Court declined to hear his case, but the United States Supreme Court saw that record, was overwhelmed by it, and decided to grant what's called certiorari, which means that they will hear the case.
Okay, so the Georgia Supreme Court, the lawyers or legal team said, please hear this case. The Georgia Supreme Court said no. So then how does it get to the Supreme Court?
Right, so then what happens is someone files, in this case, Mr. Foster and his lawyers file what's called a petition for certiorari, which is just a fancy way of saying, a brief that says, please hear my case. And there are about 8,000 of those every year that are filed.
Wow.
Yeah. And only about 80 are granted. And so in his particular circumstances, he was one of those 8,000 initial petitions. And then he was one of the 80 or so that the Supreme Court decided to grant that year.
So how do they decide on which 80 cases to hear in a given year?
Sure. There are couple of ways that that can happen, or maybe three. So the most common way is that courts of appeals are divided, right? So one court has said that the law is A, another court has said that the law is B. Sometimes you can get really fancy with it, and another court has said that the law is C, and the court wants to resolve that issue. That's the vast majority of cases that the court grants. Another set of circumstances, though, is issues of tremendous national importance, right? So there may be some circumstances in which there needs to be clarity about what the law is.
So that's why the Supreme Court took on the travel ban, the Muslim travel ban.
The travel ban case is a really good example of that. That circumstance. And then in death penalty cases, the court is more willing than it is in other types of cases to step in just when it sees a clear error of law, even if there is no split, because of the stakes, namely, someone's life is in their hands. And in that case, I believe the seven justices concluded that this was a violation of the 14th Amendment. And there was only one dissent, because at the time, Justice Scalia was not on the court.
But not all death penalty cases make it to the Supreme Court.
That's right. They're just more likely to in the event of an egregious legal error.
How about the case when there was a water dispute between Florida and Georgia, one of the cases that was heard just last month?
Sure, right? So now we're getting really in the weeds, which is great.
I don't know how weedsy
No, but this is fun, though, because, this is, I'm a Fed courts professor, so this kind of thing gets me excited. So another way that a case can get to the Supreme Court, and this is quite rare. rare. And that's what's called the court's original jurisdiction. So there are a handful of circumstances in which someone doesn't actually even have to initially file in a trial court and make its way through the entire system. They can go directly to the United States Supreme Court. And the most common circumstance where that's true is when one state is suing another state. When that happens, they don't need to go through all of the other procedural barriers. They can go directly to the Supreme Court and say, you know, in this case, Florida suing the state of Georgia over, of course, a waters dispute.
All right. So let's go back to these 80 cases that are heard each year. We don't hear about all of these. We just hear
Probably
about
not.
What the big social issues, that's, you know, the gay marriage, the refusing to bake a cake, that kind of thing.
That's right.
What are all the other cases?
They're cases where the courts of appeals are divided. And they tend to be important issues. Certainly to the parties, and perhaps in many circumstances beyond that, important for questions of justice, important for questions related to business and the economy. But they're not hot button issues, and often there is tremendous agreement among the justices in those particular cases. So we hear about the cases that divide 5-4 and the like. But my term, for example, when I clerked there for Justice Sotomayor, I think most cases were unanimous. And the question really was, it was more important that there be a clear answer than there be a right answer, in the sense that different courts had reached different conclusions. There were very well-reasoned, thought-out reasons for lots of different rulings of law. But the important thing was that there be clarity, and that's often what those cases were. So they weren't always the most exciting cases from the perspective of the news and the like, but for the litigants or for the businesses or for the criminal defendant. Or for the person who's languishing in prison, or for the people who are languishing in prison, those cases are important.
Well, we hear an awful lot about how Supreme Court justices get to the court, but we're hearing a little bit about how cases actually get to the Supreme Court with Fred Smith. He's Associate Professor of Law at Emory University. Okay, let's go back to that kind of process. They get 8,000 appeals, petitions, or what was the word?
Petitions for certiorari.
Okay. All right. So they get those petitions. How do they make a decision on which cases actually get heard?
Yeah. So again, the most important factor generally is that there is a split of opinion.
Right.
That's really where the action is.
Yeah, I got that. But how about do they read through
the mechanics of the process? So the question sort of is, do the justices take a pile of 8,000 petitions and sort through them? The answer is almost.
Wow, so, that's impressive.
So what ends up happening actually is that for most of the justices, I believe at this point it's still 7 justices, they participate in what's called the cert pool. And what that means is that one clerk for one of those 7 justices will read the petition and will write a short memo about that petition. So they'll describe the facts, they'll describe the law, they'll describe any split of opinion among the lower courts, and they'll make a recommendation about whether to take that case. The recommendation isn't the important thing, especially because the clerks almost always recommend deny. The important thing is whether or not there in fact is a deeply rooted split of opinion on an important legal issue. And so the justices take a look at that. And so they all certainly read that memo. It's kind of harder to read every petition.
Right.
They may go back and pull the petition if they need to, if there's something that, but typically the action at that point is in the much, much, much shorter memo that one of the clerks has written.
That puts a lot of power in the hands of the clerks, doesn't it?
In some sense. All right. So
In their interpretation, maybe. That's
sure, I'll give you that. I mean, I hesitate about the word power, right? Because they're not, the clerks at no moment are the ones making the decision. And again, their recommendation isn't the important thing. But sure, I mean, there is a level of trust that's put in the clerk. That they're going to be reading the petition thoughtfully and carefully. That also might put some importance on the 2 justices who are not in the cert pool, right? Because there is at least then some accountability to the extent that Someone who's not in the cert pool says, actually, that I read that petition and I read it differently. And I actually think that we should hear this case. And here's why. So that might be an additional check as well.
And then the cases are argued in front of the court.
That's right.
That's an interesting dynamic, the conversations that happen in between, the questions that they are asking the lawyers.
Sure.
It's often interpreted that they're not really talking to the lawyers, they're talking to each other. Is that accurate?
I think that that's accurate. I think that most of the questions that are asked have very little to do with the lawyer who's in front of them and has much more to do with persuading their colleagues. And the reason for that is that the justices don't talk about these cases nearly as much as you might think they do. As a matter of fact, they have almost certainly not talked about the case at all. By the time it gets to oral argument, the only conversation they've had about it is whether to grant the case. And so it's the first opportunity to kind of highlight the key arguments from the perspective of the justices, for them to kind of telegraph where they stand, what makes them persuadable. And of course, the dynamic in recent years has been that once Justice Kennedy speaks, most of the questions were basically new iterations of Justice Kennedy's question, because it showed what he cared about. And so on controversial questions, the justices would sort of try to figure out a way to convince him in particular.
Well, that's going to change.
That is about to change.
And then they all go and sit in a chamber and talk together?
That's what they do next, exactly, right? So either that day or the next day, they sit around a big conference table and they go around in order of seniority, with accepting the chief. The chief begins. The chief is always the most senior, even if they're not technically the most senior. And then they go around the table and they say, here is how I intend to vote, and here's why I intend to vote that way. They're not really, even at that moment, it's not deliberative. They're not interjecting and saying,
right.
Well,
they're not saying, but how about this?
Exactly.
And he said that.
They're literally just saying, here's how I intend to vote, and here's why. And then of the majority, whoever's the most senior member of the majority, again, with the exception being the chief is always the most senior, they select who writes the majority opinion, and then among the dissenting judges or justices, the most senior dissenting justice decides who writes the dissenting opinion.
So this is a branch of government that, you know, is cloaked in a sense of secrecy, even though we get reporting on it. What do you think, Fred, people misunderstand about the court, or what you'd like them to know?
I would like them to know that I think that what makes the court work, and this is what I came away with when I clerked there, is that all of the justices have deep respect for each other's intellect and each other's integrity. They may deeply disagree about the law. They might deeply disagree about what justice requires. But they always respect each other's intellect and integrity. And that's why it functions as well as it does.
Thank you so much for bringing us through that.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's
Fred
a pleasure
Smith,
to be here.
He's Associate Professor of Law at Emory. Now, just ahead, we're going to talk about another great American institution, high school football. But first, more than 9 million American adults vape regularly. We're going to find out why. This is On Second Thought.
Sarah was completely wasting